Ladies and gentlemen, you're watching or listening to Cast Erebus. My name is Christian Corley. The gentleman to my left or right or however you're watching this is James McLean. And we'll be in the same speaker if it's on audio. We are here to talk about things once again. We've stumbled upon an idea to discuss. But before we get to that, it's just a slightly related thing, James. I've been watching, because we were talking about Christmas initially. I've been watching BBC One Christmas trailers on YouTube.
Yeah.
Going back decades from the early 80s and things, and then late 70s.
Yeah, so like things like the Woolworths ones.
Well, no, I have been watching those, no, but I was meaning specifically BBC One trailers, so like all the TV shows, you know, all the big shows for Christmas.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah.
So, you know, there's everything, Markham and Wise, Blue Peter, Top of the Pops, all the people have been banged up and shamed since the 70s. It's an interesting way of, and how the BBC promotes its Christmas programming through the years is it hasn't changed an awful lot. It's all very kind of like self-congratulatory, and this is what we've got. Even if it's like a 20-year-old movie on Christmas Day, it's like it's their number one in the schedules. And these days, a 20-year-old movie wouldn't be such a, in fact, it wasn't even 20-year-old, I think it was probably a 30 or 40-year-old movie, because it was in black and white. These days, like, the idea of putting a 40-year-old movie out isn't particularly brave on Christmas Day, I don't think, because they're not in black and white. But I think in the early 80s, a 40-year-old movie that's in black and white on Christmas Day evening, I think that's quite a brave move.
Well, it's only brave compared to what one other channel is putting on, isn't it?
Yes.
That's how it was.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. So you were telling me earlier about some deleted scenes.
You can edit this out, but fuck the deleted scenes for a second.
Okay.
I kind of like this. I like the idea of BBC One's almost self-congratulatory package, because it kind of was and kind of is. And that's a really interesting space to be in, isn't it? Because ITV's wasn't quite the same. I suppose there was a bit of a similar vibe.
Well, with ITV, you're not guaranteed. The thing with ITV, they have to really big it up, don't they? The BBC knows that they don't have any adverts. The only time people are likely to turn over is between shows, whereas ITV always has the risk of advert comes on, someone's going to hold a remote control, or, I mean, not so much in them days, unless they've got a cable or they've got a stick or whatever. But there's always that risk that someone's going to turn the telly over when there's an advert on.
But there's something, I think, about the BBC's identity, isn't there? And it really used to sell itself, especially back then, on its almost like it's, I don't know whether it's like it's a community, and it's not a menagerie, but it's almost, and it's not quite a family, but I suppose almost like it's family, it's collective of sort of in-house stardom. So sort of having, as you say, obviously not just the now disgraced personalities, but things like, you know, Bob Monkhouse, Jimmy Tarbuck was kind of ITV a lot of the time.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Bruce Forsyth and the like, and that, and even the sort of almost like the family of shows as well, where the shows themselves are almost like the celebrities as too. So like,
yeah.
Only Fools and Horses, and then they, as you say, then they would kind of drop the big guest, which has come to the party. So I think, yeah, it was almost like it was a party which you were invited to, and all the familiar faces that you really liked and wanted to know and hang out with were around, plus a few exciting guests, you know, some exotic ones from across the seas, like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom at 8 o'clock. There was that sort of sense of, yeah, like you were coming to a mate's Christmas party. And they were your friends.
Yeah.
But most importantly, They were your only friends. The only other friends you had was a sort of slightly awkward, geeky guy called BBC Two, who no one really wanted to hang out with much, would like to admit to hang out with much. Channel Four, who is like this sort of 80-year-old who had swear words. And then there was big, fat ITV, who just kind of bought everything but just didn't really have any personality. The person you wanted to hang out with was Captain BBC One and go to his house, and that was sort of the vibe of it.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
The sad thing is that guy's got older, and he still thinks he's got it, and he hasn't. But he's still there sort of trying to sort of give out that same sort of, you know, come to my house.
Yeah.
You know, we've got Strictly, you know, and we've got a Marvel film. And it's all like, yeah, BBC, John BBC One guy is still asking me to come over. He's still got the same old tat though, you know. And it's a bit embarrassing. We'll go over some of the guests are all right. I don't mind meeting them for a bit, but I don't want to hang out there too long because, you know, it's a bit old-fashioned and a bit embarrassing, really.
He's been wheeling out the same stuff for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
The same dessert. He's been the same dessert he's had for the last 20 years, yeah. I was talking to Kerry about, my wife, about this the other day, because you know, it's not just BBC, ITV has this as well, you know, with just stumbling into the later series of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and you know, there's the Homes Under the Hammer, A Place in the Sun, all those types of shows, and you can put on you could just go on YouTube and watch an episode of Harry Hill's TV Burp, which finished over 10 years ago. I think it's 12 or 13 years ago since that finished. And it is still relevant. And it shouldn't be, should it? If we were talking when TV Burp finished, the shows from like 20 years before that, 15, 20 years before that, they were almost long gone apart from the soap operas. But now everything is a long-running TV show.
Hmm.
And culturally, that's weird, isn't it? Because it feels like we haven't really progressed.
Well, we haven't. Market for for broadcast television are the people who don't kind of progress. So like 40 pluses, mm-hmm. who,
that's all,
you know, you're a stage, yeah, your stage of your life where you're not necessarily, you know, you're kind of, I mean, oh, come on, let's let you go to Instagram or TikTok. You see, or YouTube, you go to any nostalgia video, you know, like you're talking about, and in the comments it'll be just like, oh, take me back. Oh, yeah. Give me a time. I want to be back there. Oh, it was so much better then, you know, better than the stuff we've got now. Oh, that was the age. We have to live, you know, and there's all this really sort of rose-tinted, which we have, and you do as you get older, and you could sort of say, well, it's because the 80s were better. But strangely enough, people in the 80s were saying the same about the 50s. Or the 40s, not so much the
40s, James.
Not so much maybe the 40s, but you know, I don't know. But then that is the interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, maybe the 40s is a funny one because while the people who lived through it may not have same, well, some of them do because, you know, especially if they were children. Yep. I remember my grandparents. There was a sort of sense of the camaraderie is what they remembered. You know, there was little to eat, but people got together, and there was a sort of sense. You know, the fact that there was bombs falling everywhere and people dying. And I don't mean this in a rude, frivolous way, wasn't a bit which seemed to attach to their cultural memory of those moments. It was and somehow that has been co-opted by people who didn't live through it. You know, the 50s, you look at the stuff that's shown on, you know, like Father Brown, as we've talked about before, this idyllic notion of the 50s where everything was really gentle and, yeah, there was a lot of murders, but, you know, very, very gentle space where everyone was still slightly progressive, and, you know, all the people that mattered did, and that was fine. You know, Downton Abbey is another example. You know, okay, not many people lived through the eras of Downton Abbey now, but Downton Abbey, all the elites are actually really nice, quite pretty nice. The people, this is my sister always says this, this isn't my point, but I think it's quite good. Downton Abbey, all the people who are problematic are the people working under the stair, you know, in the kitchens, or the servants. They're the ones who do the sexual abuse or do the, you know, or are the criminals and stuff. The people who are running the show in these big abbeys and manors are actually all right. They're actually quite progressive, and they kind of like their staff. And yeah, they might have some dodgy people too, but they're actually, they're almost like the moral compass.
Yeah, but it's just a drama, though.
But that was never like it was. But that drama kind of reflects on what people want to remember of the past.
Well, it's an idol, isn't it? Yeah.
It was, you know, they don't want to remember that, you know, in a lot of these cases, not all of them, you know, that obviously throughout history, people in power tend to, as we talked about with the BBC, people in power tend to often be quite abusive because power corrupts.
Yeah.
But you don't see that in those programs remembering the sort of lords of the manor back then. The lords were very benign. And it was the working class who were kind of, the people just didn't quite get it.
The oiks.
And then the oiks in the 40s and the 50s. So we do just have this weird way of remembering stuff.
Yeah.
So going back to the point, I think that's kind of why that sort of output is kind of fixed still, because we don't particularly want to move on. We like the sort of stuff we like. And whether, you know, I can't imagine, although the BBC probably will, where it will start trying to inject different sort of formats, which will try and pull more of the young people, shorter things. Maybe more online stuff as it builds its online content. So it's not just a delivery space for its, you know, older person stuff.
Well,
but we'll see. I mean, Traitors, as we say, has been very, very big for them. You know, there are those pocket moments where they do manage to pull in a young audience. So I don't know.
I mean, you mentioned earlier that we, 40-year-olds and onwards are sort of hankering for the past, etc. But I mean, I'm not sure that's entirely true. I mean, it probably is in the sense of that kind of demographic that's tuning into the BBC and ITV and watching the same shows they were watching 20 years ago. I don't count myself in that group particularly, unless I happen to be at someone else's house. We were watching...
You literally spend every week talking about Doctor Who.
Apart from that...
And if you're not talking about Doctor Who, you're talking about Midsummer Murders. So don't tell me that you've got this like progressive streak here.
Kerry and I have been watching Tulsa King on Paramount.
Right.
With Sylvester Stallone. I expected it to be okay. I'm not a big fan of Stallone. I admire the fact that, you know, he's written a successful movie and starred in it and part directed it, etc. And I'm not a big fan of his action stuff or anything like that. So I came into this thinking it might be okay, but I don't think it's going to be, you know, it's not going to be, I'm not going to be enjoying it as much as I enjoyed, say, Justified. And we started watching it, and it was with like 5-6 episodes in, I'm quite entertained by it. I'm enjoying it quite a bit.
But that is actually made demographically for people like you.
Is it?
I mean, that's why Stallone. They've got some other older actors in there as well, isn't there? Some kind of bigger names. Is that the one?
I don't know about that one. There's another one that's got Pierce Brosnan in it, which we haven't watched.
But there's a lot of stuff that, you know, Paramount's firing out, which is kind of for an older age demographic. Now, it's not to say the younger people can't get into it, but as soon as you've got a star like Stallone, if you go and speak to any 20-year-olds these days, they won't know who Stallone is. He's got no star power because he doesn't exist outside of... And Expendables is like 10 years old as well. So you are still watching stuff which is kind of... And I'm not knocking you, Christian, because we do it. And it's not like knocking 40-year-olds now. And I agree with you. I'd sort of say to some degree...
James is 50.
Is probably younger than they were before. But...
And I am next month, just to clarify things. I don't want to go down on James.
I actually thought you were older than me by a month.
No, I'm a few weeks younger than you.
Okay, fine.
But yeah, we're not just talking 40; we're talking 50 as well. We need to move our age.
We're talking about you. So
okay, fine.
We're talking 40s, aren't we? I'm coming for the 40-year-olds. That ridiculous group of people. How embarrassing to be them.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think invariably when you get older, you tend to become more locked in your ways. I mean, there's this thing that going around the social medias at the moment, that this factual stat that when you get older, your musical tastes lock in your early 20s or teens and don't progress. I don't 100% agree with that.
I don't either.
But invariably, when you get older, you've got, like, as you all know, you've got kids, you've got mortgages, you've got work. The time to have disposable income and to sort of invest in finding new things, or even having the groups of people who are doing the same thing. So you do find new things through association, which is kind of how you do it when you're at school. The opportunities become less. So I don't think it's because you become older and you become locked in your tastes. I think to some degree it's because you're locked into taste with other people who are locked into tastes because they're all busy. They just don't have that freedom. So I think looking and finding new stuff becomes harder. And yeah, you look back to the times where you were free to find new stuff and where things were a little more exciting. So I think that's why 40-year-olds are a bit more locked in. But I'm not saying we don't find interesting new stuff. And I think, yeah, that would be a fallacy, especially these days. I think we are. I mean, you know, if you think about, oh, I don't know, now I'm getting a bit scared. I was going to say, if you think of like people you knew when you were kids who were in your 40s, you know, what did they do?
Well, they all looked a lot older.
Well, yeah, there's that thing, and there's that stupid meme about that, you know, that really annoys me, where they put that guy from Cocoon next to, I don't know, the kid from Dune or someone, and they find a real outlier who looks really young and put it against someone who's in a film to actually look old, and then go, hey, look at this, or the guy from Seinfeld, and they go, look at him at 30 compared to, and it's like, yeah, but you look at them all now, they're all wearing wigs. Or, you know, some of them have got hair transplants, but a lot of them are wigs. They're all got facial work.
Yeah.
They're not natural. This notion that celebrity people are somehow a different genetic breed than everyone else and are now staying young, and it's incredible, and that's the baseline. And it's like, they're not staying young. They're just using more. And then people go, oh, it's because we smoke less now. And it's like, it's not just that. You know, if you put a wig on the guy from Seinfeld, he looks 30. It's just he hasn't got any hair.
Yeah.
And these days, you don't see any celebrities who do very rarely who don't have hair. It's not because they're not losing their hair as they get older. I mean, I'm talking about people in their 40s and 50s again, but it's because they're all wearing wigs, and that's just how we do it now. And they're just very good. They're very good. You know, and a lot of the times it's wigs, because wigs are easier to control than hair transplants, because, you know, hair does still fall out. So they wear wigs, but no one talks about it. So we have this really weird level of aesthetic beauty in people getting older, which is ridiculous, which they didn't have back in the 80s. So this notion that, you know, we look younger now, I think we probably... It's a really interesting point, though, isn't it, Christian? Because I know there's a bit of me which is like, yeah, we do live younger. And then I look at the stuff behind you, and I think there's a lot of DVDs there from 20 years ago. Would someone in their 40s back in the 80s have stuff on their shelves which were from the 60s? Do you know what I mean? But you'd look at that and just go, oh, they're still old. I don't know. Are we young? We must be, because we have toys. we watch TV. You know, we watch cartoons openly. A lot of us don't, not all of us, don't dress like 40-year-olds, as we'd imagine. But then do the 20-year-olds now think that we do dress like 40-year-olds? You know,
well, that's the thing. I think they do.
Do 40-year-olds wear flannel? Do they?
Yeah. My
son, we have a certain aesthetic, which is...
My son was asking me about my hair the other day, and whether I had a particular hairstyle when I was his age, which he has sported on a few occasions. And I mean, it's the resemblance is scary. And, you know, I said, yes, I do. I'm surprised that you have it, because there's absolutely no way I would have had the haircut of my dad at my age when I was your age. You know, it's if that makes sense, you know, whatever.
Well, look, I wonder that. I mean, it's like I see a lot of Nirvana t-shirts. That is like when I was a kid. The rock beat combo band Nirvana from the 90s. I see a lot of their t-shirts, or Alice in Chains sometimes, or Guns N' Roses. And I just think back, you know, would people in the 90s be wearing stuff from the early 60s? You know, there's, even if I've got my maths right there, there is a weird compression. And I think in a weird way, our generation is a lot younger than our previous versions of our generation, our iterations of our generation. I think, and I'm not sure what that is. I think it's because the young market doesn't have a cutoff like it used to, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to think about that. But like, you know, if you grew up watching Cowboys and Indians, and that's a terrible phrase, but that's what they used to call it in the 90s, watching those Westerns and playing those in that sort of game, would you have like a room in your house which was filled with you know, replica guns and replica posters. And there is something about older people now, and the same with Doctor Who, isn't it? Where we've kind of grown up. Maybe it's because we've grown up with sort of the ability to have mass merchandise, which we didn't have when we were a kid. We had it, Star Wars did it with toys, but that was about it. But now, whatever sort of you liked from a kid, you can sort of have, you can keep. So you sort of, you can cling on to your youth in a way far more than maybe you could in the 70s or the 80s, including Doctor Who. Well, you know, yeah. I'm sitting here at a desk and, you know, I've got a sonic screwdriver sitting by my, you know, which you couldn't have when you were in, you know, the 80s, they didn't exist. You know, the ways to actually physically have those mementos of things which matter to you just weren't there. It's a really weird one, isn't it? Because I feel that there is a lot that sort of says, I see a lot of reels that sort of say how Gen X and sort of late millennials, early millennials, sorry, are kind of like a different sort of vibe to being old. They were 30 when they were too young, and now they're sort of like 13 when they're old. There's a sort of weird, the latchkey generation who kind of were out on their bikes by themselves, how, you know, a lot of freedoms, kind of feral. And but at the same time, there's a bit of me which is like, are we quite as cool as we thought, you know, as we think we are? I don't know man, it's a weird one. There's a podcast in here somewhere, I don't know where it's gone. You're talking about deleted scenes.
There was a potential for us to talk about,
but this
scenes.
Does kind I this kind of links though to some degree to deleted scenes, doesn't it? Because in a very weird way, but I'll let you introduce deleted scenes since that's what you do.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Deleted scenes. So we were talking beforehand because James told me that some deleted scenes from the previous series or previous two series of Doctor Who had been released, I think, in order to celebrate Doctor Who being 62 this year. And
yeah.
I'm not great at maths. I'm pretty sure it's 62. No, I haven't looked at these deleted scenes, but I understand from my colleague here that they omitted anything with Caroline Ford. Is that right?
Yeah, it's nothing big.
Right.
They are, and this again goes back to almost what we were saying, the deleted scenes to me, and it was just when we were talking pre-show, just how we've had like 30 years of deleted scenes, if we're kind, on DVDs mm-hmm. and the likes. The specialness of deleted scenes has kind of worn away, that unless they've got meaning, they're the same sort of stuff that you would see on the cutting room floor in virtually every other deleted scenes. Like there's a quite nice scene in there where they in series two, when they first enter the police box and they do the whole thing of her looking around and sort of going outside and coming back in. And it's a nice play, slightly different to what we've seen before, but not massively. And that's largely what that bit is about. And it's like, and then it extends out a bit into the Doctor sort of saying where they can go and what they can do and kind of the vibe that you saw in the scene at the time. And so the little moments like that, there's sort of like pocket moments, which are nice. But I think for people who watch deleted scenes, which tend to be a generation who probably grew up with DVDs and the like, because that's what deleted scenes mean, rather than extra scenes, they're kind of, you know, I almost feel like we've been, that they're kind of boring now, you know? They kind of feel like part of the, I don't know, it's like, what?
Well, they have to have a purpose, don't they? If they either show something completely different, done in a completely different way, and not so much deleted scene, but I was always, you know, like the alternative Pertwee titles with the rubber band mm-hmm. sound, that sort of thing. Or something like a scene that, because, you know, like these days lots of movies get reshot, don't they? After they've had like a test audience and got feedback and stuff like that, so they go away and shoot scenes and maybe the ending of the movie is different, that sort of thing, where, you know, there's this almost an alternative reality for the movie or the TV show, it becomes apparent through the deleted scene. But if it's just the scene that you've seen shot in a slightly different way, that's not very interesting to me.
is when it's scenes which have had the fat chopped from the thing, which are probably the less interesting. If there's something which, I suppose the risk is if you show them something which is really interesting, then you get the shouts of like, well, why wasn't it in the, why was it chopped? I'd like to see it. I mean, we've seen that with, there's that famous Return of the Jedi one of Luke in the cave building his lightsaber, which was deleted out. And there's a lot of people who are kind of like, that should have been in. And it's a nice little moment, but you can see why it's out, because you just don't need it. And it just, and we've seen in those extended versions where they've added stuff, it just hits the rhythm.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just a funny thing to lead to scenes now that they just kind of lack their charm, because they're invariably, you're looking for something which very often they just don't give you. You're looking for something spicy or exciting or something which makes you rethink a moment or an element of the plot which has been lost, and often they're just not there. I mean, I didn't watch them in great detail, so maybe there was something really sparkly in there that I missed. But I think that goes back to the point why I didn't watch them in great detail, because I just knew there'd be nothing there that would show me anything which I hadn't seen in other deleted scenes. They almost become a genre in their own right. You know, the deleted scene of a slightly longer intro to a scene, the slightly longer conversation to a scene where the conversation was cut down a bit, a moment of seeing a new area. It's just you just know the sort of things you're going to see, and it's kind of sad in a way that you can become cynical to extra material. But I suppose also when you know with Doctor Who, for them it was hard because they knew what people really wanted to see. They wanted to know what happened with Carol Ann Ford. So anything you put out, in a sense, just reminds people that obviously quite an intrinsic part of where the show was going to go, which a lot of people would have been interested in. And there's people who kind of feel frustrated for the actor as well to have lost those scenes. That's what they want to know about. They want to know more about. And really, it's only her who's actually talked about it.
Yeah. Yes. I'm not really sure the last time I actually watched a deleted scene on anything.
Exactly.
Really. It is just a thing that... It's a thing that they've got that they can put out. And it's content, isn't it? And, you know...
But back in the 90s, it wasn't just content. It was actually...
Yeah.
Because you had again, this is where you start to sound old, but because there was that limited, there wasn't the oracle of the internet where you could just find stuff. The stuff that you could find was limited. So stuff that was officially released, what did actually have, was a bit of a goldmine, because you just didn't have that ability to access that material in the way that you can now.
Yes.
So things like deleted scenes were actually quite special. Commentaries were, and commentaries still are to a degree. I don't tend to watch them because I don't tend to buy DVDs anymore, but there is something characterful in commentaries. You get a good commentary that in itself becomes its own layer of engagement, but deleted scenes.
If you're listening on Patreon, stay tuned for further conversations between myself and James McLean. If you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and everywhere else, then you need to subscribe to the podcast through Patreon to listen to the extended version of the podcast. And for you, it's the end of the show. So let us know what you think about this, actually, because it's quite an interesting topic. It's probably one that I feel this might be one of those things that we'll come back to in future as things develop and people get sick of social networks, etc., and all those other kind of enclosed spaces in the digital world. And let us know what you thought about the deleted scenes topic as well. We'll be back for another episode soon. Until then, it's goodbye from us.